Media Network Plus. Produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Hello and welcome to the program. This weekend, the Pacific Games will kick off in Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby. The city is buzzing with last-minute preparations. That extends to the country's national broadcaster, the NBC, where about 30 men and women are learning to be commentators. Guided by the ABC broadcaster, Aaron Kearney, the NBC staff are driven by the desire to see PNG unite under the banner of sport, and lots of it. Liam Cochran reports from Port Moresby.
One and goes to heading for the try line, and no, he just been pulled and dragged back there by great defenders from Paga Panthers, a meter shot from the Paga Panthers try line.
My name is Ben, and my day-to-day job is just traditionally news. At one stage in my life while working as a general, I had a thought that I really wanted to be a commentator or something of that sort. Yeah, I find myself sometimes, you know, just sitting down and imagine that I'm doing that and just looking at the newspapers and trying to, you know, call a game or something like that. And the interest is there, but just that there's lack of opportunities where we can really come out and be exposed to calling games. So I never knew that there were two people, you know, in a team calling a game. Like, there has to be an analyst and then a commentator or play-by-play commentator. So this is totally new to me. I had in mind that there's only one person doing the calling of the game and doing analysis and all those. So it's something new.
Now, Paga Panthers now cross for our next 4-pointer this afternoon.
It's a beautiful try there. You can see that the center for Paga Panthers, as far as weight and size is concerned, he's much more taller and stronger, so he's...
Hi, my name is Aaron Kearney, and I'm the facilitator of a series of workshops that are being conducted with NBC staff ahead of the 15th Pacific Games in July in Port Moresby. This is very much a defining event for Papua New Guinea because it really is to Port Moresby and Papua New Guinea as the Sydney Olympics were to Sydney and Australia, and they really feel like this is an opportunity for them to present themselves in a new and positive light on the world stage and domestically to provide a really positive sporting and cultural festival that everybody can gather under as a nation.
And the Pacific Games, from me personally, I think is one big unifying factor for Papua New Guinea because it cuts across all sorts of boundaries regardless of geographical constraints and even our cultural limitations, if I may say. For instance, we are a diverse country here, so it's very difficult to bring in a person from the highlands and try to, you know, merge him with somebody from the coastal area, but I think this is big for Papua New Guinea. Yeah, the flex up and Gus, the weather. We had a bit of rain this morning, but the rain has stopped, and the weather here is good at Murray Barracks Field.
My name is Augustine, that's the name I use, and the radio name is Gus. Straight after the first workshop, when I got back there, my first crossover I did it was from Robal. It was a softball competition, and I did it, and it was very, very interesting for people in East Britain to listen to, and at the end I got comments like, finally, every time you listen to rugby and softball, it's the first time, and they congratulated me. They called me up and said, it's good, you have to start somewhere. Somewhere you have to start. And it's a great opportunity for me, and I have to take it, and I have to take the challenge, and I have to do it. I have to face it and go for it, and I have to create something that people will remember and will laugh about, and I can be remembered on NBC and the 2015 Pacific Games and sports live coverage.
It has the potential to make you feel like a nation in a way that perhaps few other things have in the past. Is that an appropriate statement?
Yes, Aaron, I think this is one very big event for us. While saying this, I can feel a bit, you know, emotional, yes.
And you're going to be a part of it?
Yeah, and that's the beauty of it now. And I'm hoping that several years down the line, you know, I can have it played again, and then I'm saying, yeah, that was me. Maybe I will have gray hairs then.
You might have grey hairs before the end of the Pacific
Games.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was Liam Cochrane reporting from Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. Nick Davies is an award-winning investigative journalist responsible for undercovering the News of the World phone hacking scandal. He is the author of Hack Attack, How the Truth Caught Up with Rupert Murdoch. Davies currently works for The Guardian, but has reported for The Evening Standard, London Daily News, and World in Action. He tells Margaret Thornsby how the phone hacking scandal all came to light. It seems like a little bit of an accident.
Yeah, I was on the radio talking about a different book I wrote about falsehood and distortion in the media. And in that book, there was a little bit about newspapers breaking the law and doing criminal things to get stories. And they had this horrible guy from the News of the World called Stuart Kuttner in the studio to have a go at me. And so he had a go. And he said, oh, Mr. Davis lives on another planet. And he said, oh, well, one reporter at the News of the World broke the law once and he went to prison. That's all there is to it. Well, that was a stupid thing for Stuart Kuttner to do, which eventually actually ended up with him on trial at the Old Bailey. But the immediate effect was that it provoked somebody I'd never heard of into getting in touch with me. And this very good person told me how wrong Stuart Kuttner was about the systematic law-breaking at the News of the World.
How did that person know about all of that?
I know, but that's an off-the-record source.
Okay.
But so what that source also knew was that the police were sitting on detailed evidence of all this crime being committed and had chosen not to pursue it. And that's what starts to get you into a really interesting story, that it isn't about journalists behaving badly. That's just the beginning of it. It's about power. And why would the most powerful police force in Britain not pursue all this evidence of crime, which was sitting in their own archives?
And what's the answer to that question?
It's about fear. Fear of this powerful newspaper organisation
and
its owner.
Is it about corruption as well?
There is financial corruption in the background. That's a different thing. It runs in parallel, where the newspaper were paying cash to low-level officers to give them bits of information because a celebrity's caught shoplifting. But the failure at the top of the police to go after this ultimately is about fear, that you don't want to get into a fight with Rupert Murdoch. And the key thing is, it's the same in the corridors of power in government, that Rupert has undermined the democracy of my country. And probably yours. And so that's what the book, about a third of the book is about that, about how Rupert and his lieutenants bullied, cajoled and manipulated government ministers and officials to get their way over one thing or another.
Let's talk about the Murdoch people in a moment, but just let's refresh our minds on what was actually happening. People's phones were being hacked. In other words, people's phones, people like celebrities or actors or stars, were being hacked, and members of the royal family, so that people were getting into their voice messages and finding out their private information.
That's right. It's so anybody they wanted to write about. This newspaper, the News of the World, was selling primarily by getting inside people's private lives.
So they were their having scoops on saying so-and-so is about to break up with her husband.
Yes, it's an awful lot to do with what people are doing in their bedrooms. Mm. But so, we know of 5,500 victims, people whose voicemails were being intercepted. So that's, you know, footballers and actors and politicians and anybody who could conceivably catch their eye as a victim for a story. And it's cheating. And there was, apart from intercepting voicemail, there's been other crime going on with the News of the World and our newspapers. So tapping live phone calls, which is more serious, hacking into emails. There's been a little bit of burglary on the side as well. But so they're above the law. So why would the law matter? So they do whatever it takes.
There was one individual who was hacked who wasn't a nobody, and that was Millie Dowler.
Yes, she's a 12-year-old schoolgirl who was abducted and murdered. And when it was disclosed that they had been listening to the voicemail left by her parents and friends begging her to get in touch, that was just too much. I mean, this was at the end of a sequence of about 100 stories we'd published.
So what was in it for the News of the World? What was the Millie Dowler story? What was in it for the News of the World to reveal?
Well, it's not as specific as that. It's routine that Millie's disappearance was a big news story, so they want to get some new angle on it. So they would do illegal things to try to get an angle, whatever it might be. Mm. Ultimately, they picked up a message there, which, in fact, had been left for somebody else. It shouldn't have been on Millie's phone at all, but they thought it meant that Millie was alive and working in a factory in the southwest of England. So they didn't tell anybody that they'd found this. and they went off to try to find her, because that would have been a big scoop. Mm. Millie's alive and the News of the World saves the day.
Was it just the News of the World? Was it just Murdoch papers? Were other Fleet Street papers involved?
Yeah, certainly the Mirror Group newspapers. You know, the Daily Mirror, Sunday Mirror, Sunday People, big newspapers.
Who owns them?
That's a company called Trinity Mirror, big commercial organisation. But their reporters were bang at it. I think the pattern was, that I've described this in the book, the different crimes which newspapers were committing tended to start in Rupert Murdoch's newspapers, perhaps because they are particularly ruthless. And then people would leave those papers and take the crime to the others. And then it became systematic there too.
The question I'm interested in is how aware Rupert Murdoch himself might have been. One could get the picture of a man who was sitting in his office, completely shielded from all. I mean, you know, well, the muck that goes on the floor in Fleet Street has little to do with him.
Well, you know, about 18 months, 2 years ago, Murdoch had a meeting with his reporters from The Sun in London. They were pretty angry with him because, in order to stop his UK company being charged as a corporation, that company had been handing over material to the police, which had led to lots of Sun reporters being arrested and accused of paying bribes. So Murdoch has a meeting with his Sun staff, and they secretly tape recorded him. And in that tape, which they then leaked, you can hear the old boy say, "What's wrong with people paying money to the police? Newspapers have always done it."
Is that true?
Yeah, that's his own voice on the tape. It's also true. Mm-hmm. But the point is, I think that tells you where he is with this. He understood, in general terms, that his reporters and others were doing various dodgy and potentially illegal things. He knew about it in general terms. That's his voice on the tape. But you're not going to expect him to know that reporter A paid police officer B
on date C.
So at that level, he understood.
What's the culture like on the floor in the newsroom of a paper that's now News of the World closed down as a result of the Leveson inquiry? It hasn't opened up again, has it?
Well, so he opened a new newspaper, The Sun, on Sunday,
effectively
replaced
it's the same. So,
yeah. But so the culture, I mean, to go back to something we were talking about earlier, there's a regime of bullying in those newsrooms. So the commercial pressure to sell more and more copies translates into pressure from the news desk on the reporters to go out and get me something that nobody else has got.
So the reporters are the bottom of the heap. They're the worker ants who go out, and all the worker bees
They get bullied, so they go out and do ruthless things to the people they're dealing
bullying,
with.
What sort of form does the bullying take?
Well, plenty of shouting and swearing. There's plenty of, if you do what we want you to, we'll give you a pay rise, we'll let you fiddle your expenses and put some extra cash in your pocket, and we'll send you off on stories where you're going to get your byline on the front. If you do badly, you can sit in the corner of the newsroom, we're not going to give you anything to do. If you find your own story, we're going to ignore it, not put it in the paper. I mean, it can be a miserable, miserable place, a tabloid newsroom. But it's not all misery. People get drunk and have a good time. But actually, that's the other thing, is that while these guys are going out and exposing other people's use of illegal drugs or other people having affairs, some of them were bang at it themselves. And you may remember in that big trial in London, there's in the dock Andy Coulson and Rebecca Brooks, who have built careers to a significant extent out of exposing public figures who were having affairs while married. And the two of them were having an affair.
With each other?
Yes, while each of them was married. So that's just breathtaking, the cruelty to do that to other people while you're doing it yourself, and the double standards. Mm. It's just outrageous.
Andy Coulson went to jail. Yeah. Rebecca Brooks didn't. She was found not guilty. It was found that she did not know what was going on.
Correct.
What's your view of that?
I sat through just about every day of that trial, and the jury delivered the right verdict. And I know lots of people think she must have known, but that's not what criminal justice is about. You don't want to live in a society where people get sent to prison because other people think they must have committed a crime. The state has to prove a case beyond reasonable doubt, and they couldn't do it. So if I'd been sitting on that jury, I would have said, that's fine, let her walk. And I really think people should let her have her verdict. Let her have it. It's not okay if you've had a good trial to keep pursuing somebody and saying, well, they must be guilty. She's been through it.
The Leveson inquiry was into, as I recall, the culture in the press, the culture and practices in the press.
Yeah.
Did it uncover everything, do you think?
I don't know about everything, but it was pretty powerful.
Mm. What was it like sitting there listening to it?
I thought it was just amazing because in some, what you had with Leveson was that all of these powerful people, four prime ministers, numerous chiefs of police, all these very secretive creatures, the newspaper editors, government officials, they were all told, you come here and you sit in front of that microphone in a public place and you tell us what really goes on in the corridors of power. And if we think you're lying, we're going to get hold of your text messages and emails so that we can check. And just remember this little democracy idea. They're spending our money acting in our name. And it was so right that finally, just rarely, we got this chance to see how they really operate.
How many emails were destroyed I've read millions.
The Murdoch company in the UK, over a period of time, destroyed 300 million emails. And some of them was in the normal course of freeing up the servers. There was an enormous chunk of emails destroyed just as the new police inquiry began. And that was pretty extraordinary coincidence of timing. And that most of those were not recovered.
I'm not the only one who's picked up on this. The subtitle of your book, it's called Hack Attack, mm-hmm. How the truth got caught up with Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
Has it caught up with him?
I think the truth caught up with him. But then what is most significant is that it hasn't stopped. It hasn't changed very much.
Does the same thing go on still? Phones get hacked still?
No. So I think that the level of crime in our newspapers has probably dropped to zero, but that's all that's changed. So those newspapers still engage in falsehood, distortion and spite. They've just done it on a grand scale during our election campaign in the UK. And the basic structures of power in which politicians and police officers tend to bow down and allow very powerful people to have their way. Mm. We haven't changed any of that.
How was it done during the election? How much influence did the Murdoch papers hold?
The second question you've asked is a very difficult one to answer, because experts study these statistics and you can't be sure the extent to which a newspaper is changing its readers' vote and the extent to which that then changes the outcome. But what you can see is several newspapers, including Rupert Murdoch's daily, The Sun, investing an enormous effort in what isn't journalism. It's a political project to stop the British people electing a Labour government. So the result was that they didn't elect a Labour government. Whether that was crucially because of those newspapers' activity is really hard to tell. But I think it's worth noticing that they wouldn't put in so much effort if they themselves didn't think that it was worth doing so.
It's all very well for proprietors to write editorials the day before an election and say, this newspaper believes that you should vote Conservative because Labour hasn't proven its case and the Conservatives have done this, that and the other and they're going to do something else. It's another thing entirely when the leaders of Conservative, in this instance that I've just covered, the leaders therefore start swanning around with the proprietor and the proprietor gets invited to enjoy the largesse.
Well, there's that, but it's mostly what matters is what the newspaper tells its readers. And if they feed them a diet of falsehood and distortion as part of a political project, there's something deeply wrong going on. And insofar as that might affect the outcome of an election, it really matters.
Did they tell falsehoods in this?
Yes, so for example, during election campaigns, political parties often bring in volunteers to help them stuff leaflets through letterboxes. So the Labour Party did that in this occasion. So The Sun says, but these people aren't being paid. And they're volunteers, right? Nobody pays them. So then you have a big front page story saying slave labour.
And I know you're a proud investigative reporter and you teach classes, you give masterclasses on investigative journalism. Mm-hmm. And I want to know how aggressive you are in the practice of your craft, where you set your boundaries.
Aggressive. So when I do these classes, I talk to them about how the skills of reporting are actually rather odd, subtle skills. I think the most important ones, for example, cluster around building relationships with other human beings, persuading them to talk when they've already decided not to. And there's odd sorts of skills in there about really, really understanding how other people think and feel.
How do you persuade people?
Well, it's to do with that. It's to do with us understanding how somebody else is feeling. But it's a weird thing because, let's say, you have to be able to motivate a paedophile to speak to you about what he does to children. You also have to motivate the police officer who wants to catch him and probably the parents of the child who've been abused. So you've got to be able to just be the person that other people need you to be. So there's a lot of psychology goes into it, really understanding how somebody else feels, and a little bit of being an actor. I have interviewed paedophiles, and you've got to control yourself because
you want to hit them over the head.
Yeah.
But what about the possibility of someone regretting speaking to you subsequently?
Well, so if that happened, let's suppose somebody tells me something and then subsequently they get in touch and say, hey, I shouldn't have told you that, please don't use it. Then you'd make a judgment call. If it's a bad person who's told you about a bad thing they've done, I think I could easily be inclined to say, look, tough, you're a bad person and this bad thing needs to come out. But if it was somebody who was assisting me, who's a decent person, then I'd say, it's okay.
But it's your judgment about whether they're bad or decent.
Yeah, consistently. Well, how else can you survive? I mean, so reporting is riddled with ethical judgment calls, and all you can do is make the best judgment that you can.
I understand that, but in theory, let's be hypothetical for a moment, and if I'm sitting in your class and I know, if I think to myself, well, I really disapprove of people who are gay, and if you understand that about yourself and then you meet somebody who's gay and you've got that disapproval thing, then you might place different boundaries with that person than you would somebody else. Do you know what I mean? We bring our own prejudices to these things.
Well, I mean, I think the whole news industry was homophobic until sometime in the late 1960s.
I use that as an example.
No, and so they routinely behaved in a way which we would now look back on and utterly condemn. I may say those tabloid reporters in London continued to pretend that the Nation was homophobic. And they specialised, among other things, in exposing public figures who were gay. Mm. I mean, a horrible, cruel, pointless damn thing to do.
Well, but so, it becomes it has a point if that gay person is in a position of power who discriminates against gay people. And that's happened more than we can, you know. Do you know what I mean?
That wasn't what was happening here. They tended to be left-wing. There was actually a chief police officer, a really nice guy called Brian Paddock, who happened to be rather left of centre in his policing strategies. So they discovered he was gay, so he had to have his sex life exposed. Mm. That's a political judgment. Right? It's got nothing to do with the man doing something hypocritical or attacking gay people. No. They didn't like his politics. Or, I mean, insofar as public figures were the victims of the News of the World's intrusion, it's striking how the vast majority come from somewhere on the left of centre.
Ah, interesting.
Because they don't like them, you see.
What's churnalism, C-H-U-R-E?
Oh, that's a very different thing. Churnalism was a word invented by someone else that I used in the previous book I wrote about falsehood and distortion in the media, where we're trying to describe that once you starve news organisations of resources, you condemn reporters to sit glued to their keyboards, recycling second-hand information, either from news agencies like Reuters or on a vast scale from the PR industry. You're recycling press releases. And you're not out there choosing what to write about. Those second-hand sources are choosing, and you haven't got a chance to check. So we call that recycling unchecked second-hand information churnalism. You're just churning it out.
If you open your newspaper, The Guardian, how much of this, of the information contained in its pages, is fresh reported by the reporters?
And how much is journalism? A significant proportion is journalism. All news organisations are being starved of resources. And in the book, I set up a huge piece of research by some academics at a university in the UK. And so we had the percentages for each newspaper, including The Guardian.
Mm-hmm. And what was The Guardian's?
Well, so the overall figure was 56%. And this was only the posh papers. We weren't looking at the tabloids. This was Guardian, Times, Independent. So The Guardian was in there along with the others. All news organisations in the developed world are slowly dying. So whether or not they ultimately die is a big question. And I hope people worry about that, because there's a kind of silly notion that if journalism disappears, it'll be replaced by citizen journalism. And most citizen journalists are bonkers. To do proper journalism, you need resources, you need skills, you need accountability. And that isn't there with most. There are a few citizen journalists who are brilliant, but it matters very much if the business of this industry, which is supposed to go out and check facts and tell you the truth, we need somebody to do that. And I know we haven't been doing it terribly well, because we're so short of resources and for other reasons in the past. But it's important that it's protected, and nobody quite knows how we can find a new business model.
Award-winning investigative journalist Nick Davies speaking to Margaret Thornsby about how he undercovered the News of the World phone hacking scandal, which ended up closing the newspaper itself. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now time to turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect over the next 7 days and what's been happening. Things seem to be, well, quite active. Here's Glenn Hauser for more.
Keith, from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast is normal at all latitudes through July 4th. Space weather in South Africa expects quiet geomagnetic conditions through July 4th. Shortwave fade-outs unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK, the space weather forecast summary, minor storms likely on Sunday, July 5th, with geomagnetic activity otherwise predominantly quiet. From Natural Resources Canada, the 27-day magnetic forecast, most DRX nanotesla activity on July 6th and 11th in the polar and auroral zones. Peter Coleman, OK1MGW of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, says the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on July 3rd, 6th to 8th, 13th, 14th, and 18th. Active to disturbed on July 4th. Quiet to active on July 5th, 11th, 12th, 19th to 22nd. Mostly quiet on July 9th, 10th, 15th to 17th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field at active to G1 minor storm levels, July 6th to 8th and 11th and 12th, when ANK indices will peak at 18 and 5. Lowest levels of 5 and 2 through July 5th and from July 14th. Solar flux rising from 105 on July 5th to a peak of 130 July 11th to 18th and down to 100 by July 23rd. Bill Hepburn's VHF-UHF microwave DX maps show tropospheric ducting extreme this week off northwestern Mexico and over the Mediterranean, all around the Arabian Peninsula to India, and off Angola, and peaking July 6th between Bahamas and Puerto Rico.
All right, thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program or have any story ideas, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.